Greetings, everyone. I think the gay rights movement must really enjoy that second verse of that song, All the Fruits in Full Supply. Guess they think it's a song about California or something. God, just kidding. Couldn't help it. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. That's what Moses told the Israelites. That's what Joshua repeated. It's found in Deuteronomy 6, 5-7. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. How do you love God when you've never seen Him? If you look at 1 John 4, 12-21, no man has seen God at any time. Jesus said that in John 3:13, three verses before the favorite verse of all of nominal Christendom. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, and so on. No man has ascended into heaven. No man has ever seen God at any time. How do you love God when you've never seen Him? If we love one another, God dwells in us and His love is perfected in us. Hereby know we that we dwell in Him and He in us, because He has given us of His Spirit. And we have seen and do testify that the Father sent the Son to be the Savior of the world. Whosoever shall confess that Jesus is the Son of God, and I know all of you have confessed that and believe it, God dwells in him and he in God, in Theos, in the two of them. And we have known and believed that the love that God has to us, God is love, and he that dwells in love dwells in God and God in him. Herein is our love made perfect, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment, because as he is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear has torment. He that fears is not made perfect in love, and we love him because he first loved us. If any man or a man say, I love God, and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he that loveth not his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? Good question. I love art. I've been to many of the great art museums, including those in London and over in Berlin and in Paris and in, I think, Rome, yes, and down in the El Escorial in Madrid, where there are fabulous paintings and old world art, and seen some of the greatest artists of all of history. You know, you can enjoy some of it, and some of it is kind of brutal and ugly. And you see someone like one of these, Salvador Dali guy, I don't even know, impressionistic kind of thing, kind of a watch that is melting and that kind of thing. And you know by looking at the work that these people have produced, the kind of people they are. If you see a really ugly building, you probably understand the architect had a little something wrong with him. You see people who will produce things that are almost insulting to your intelligence and certainly not pleasant to look at. If you see a home and in the front yard is an old abandoned pickup truck, another abandoned car, a couple of abandoned refrigerators, a lot of junk and weeds growing up around all of it, the roof is askew, there's a lot of junk in the backyard, but there's an antenna for a television set sticking out of the roof. What is your opinion of the kind of personal pride of property about the people who live there? You know exactly what that house looks like inside by what it looks like outside. Same thing is true of people. My wife will chide me sometimes. We were in I don't remember exactly because it's happened so many times, but there was a guy that went by and he had green spiked hair. And he's walking along. I mean, it's green spikes coming out. And I said, look at that. Honey, don't do... Well, honey, that's why he does that. He wants me to notice him. And I'm just giving him what he wants. So you know what's going on in the mind of someone that walks along in an airport with green spiked hair. Look at me. I am in. Whatever that means. I am in. When I was a kid, they used to say, in with Flynn. Or in like Flynn, because Errol Flynn was a real rake, and he was known to be kind of, I guess, a smashing, handsome Australian that all the women went gaga over. And to be in like Flynn was to be, I guess, the most popular guy in high school or whatever. So young people want to be in. They want to go along with the majority, oftentimes. If I were to see things that man has made that to me are repulsive, repugnant, and ugly, I can deal with the kind of a mind that produced it. I have no idea, for example, the mind, I have a suspicion, maybe he came from San Francisco, who named the Ford, a little Ford running around, by one of the ugliest names I've ever heard put on an automobile, the Ford Focus. Now, coming here, we saw a neon. And it wasn't a tube with a light in it, it was an automobile. And they named things like this. Now, I can appraise and evaluate things that are so beautiful, so lovely, so wonderful. I remember, I think his name was Albert Bierstadt. And we used to have a painting like that, and I had a huge Bierstadt painting in my office in Pasadena. My father really appreciated him. He was known to be one of the greatest, if not the greatest, American landscape painter, artist. And he painted some of the most awesome, breathtaking scenery, like Yosemite and Yellowstone and the Swiss Alps and scenes all over the United States. And you look at that, and you are in awe, because I know I've painted probably 100 or so paintings in my lifetime and given a bunch of them away and even provided some of my poor work for the raffle at the Feast of Tabernacles. Had some in my garage that had been there for a long time. And with my feeble efforts, and they really are, I look at these people that are able to produce something like that in awe. There are works of art that you would look at, and it's awfully hard for you not to believe they are a perfect photograph. They are so true to the subject. And I love that tremendous realism. It just shows you exactly what the artist had in mind. Who made the entirety of the universe? Who creates those gorgeous sunsets like the one last night? Who creates the beautiful night when you're high in a mountain with the rarity of cool, dry air and see all those billions of stars, some of which you think are stars, but they are galaxies? Who made, I know these are made of silk, but if they were real, I could say, who made those flowers? What does a flower do? We have everything from zinnias to petunias to all kinds of flowers in our backyard. And we were just remarking as we had breakfast this morning, look at our cannas out there. They're kind of an orange and red, just gorgeous. We're commenting about the color. What do? You can't eat, well, you could, I guess. You could eat a flower. But they don't produce anything. Why aren't they so beautiful? Now, what about the fish that are down deep that the vast majority of humankind never sees? And they're every color of the rainbow. We went snorkeling one time down at Eilat in the Gulf of Aqaba, that tongue of the Red Sea that juts up into Israel. And if you can imagine the colors of these flowers, you can talk about stripes, red, white, and blue, every color, pink, purple. They look like butterflies, every kind of a fish that you can imagine. I can't even begin to recount all the colors that I saw. Why? Can't be camouflaged. That doesn't camouflage them from marauding predatory fish. It's got to be for only one reason. The blessing of man and what it is supposed to tell us about the creativity, about the mind, the inventiveness, and the love of the one who was able to produce all of these things. Now, God willing, by next Sabbath, the Brazil family here are going to have a little granddaughter. And I will guarantee you that that little baby is going to be absolutely, breathtakingly beautiful to the parents and the grandparents and to all of us. There is nothing more, I think, moving to any man, to any father or mother, than to have a little baby born. And even though I had to say, it seemed every time, interminably, honey, it's another boy, it was a great moment. My wife gave birth to two of our sons up in a little clinic in Big Sandy. She came over here to be with her mother. And it was natural childbirth, and I was standing there holding her hand on the occasion of the birth. And it just takes your breath. And you see your own little replication. You see the duplication of yourself and your wife being born, coming into the world. Nothing like it. Absolutely nothing like human reproduction. Your first child, we saw, of course, they tried to relegate me and they succeeded. I wasn't able to batter down the door. They put me in what was called the stork room while my wife was being treated by the doctors and the nurses and giving birth to our first son, Mark. But when we saw him, there is a feeling that comes over you that is indescribable. There's nothing like that. That is a unique human experience that cannot be in any way duplicated except by having another child and another and another. My wife's mother went through that 8 times. And there's enough love to go around. It wouldn't have mattered. I mean, the poor little dear shouldn't have gone through it 16 times. But let me tell you, she would have loved all of them, all 16, as equally as she loved all 8. Now, God, the Father, has billions of children. And I like to analyze that from the standpoint that no matter what you think about some Vietnamese boy or some little Laotian girl or some black African person in maybe Laos or Nigeria or right now over in Monrovia where they are in fear of their lives, God loves them and has enough love to go around for the entirety of the human race, which is why no shred of racism should dwell in our minds or our hearts, which is why they are all God's creatures, and our founding fathers said that all men are born equal, equal in the sight of God. They mentioned divine providence and God many times in that song, the second verse, In God, our motto, In God Do We Trust. Our Star Spangled Banner, very appropriate to sing that one day after the birthday of our nation being celebrated yesterday. And constantly our founding fathers referred to God. I've read a great deal of history. Every war we fought was won by the narrowest margin you can imagine. And if you read the true history of the Revolutionary War, you will come to understand what a near thing it was, miracle after miracle. Oh, you've all heard about George Washington crossing the Delaware, and you've heard about the surrender of the British, but you probably haven't really heard the whole story. It's available in the history books, and it's fascinating to read it, and about the characters who were there. Little war most people know almost nothing about. The Mexican-American War, and how Zach Taylor, who later on became a president of the United States, was down in Texas virtually doing nothing, but Texas and all of New Mexico, Arizona, and the southern half of California were being ripped away from the Mexicans by the United States. And so President Polk decided, we'll go to war. And when you read who the characters were, they were Longstreet. Does that ring a bell? Robert E. Lee, does that ring a bell? Ulysses S. Grant, does that ring a bell? They fought in that war. Robert E. Lee one time was with a group of troops. He was an engineer and was out on a scouting mission when he saw a man with a brass cannon that had been mounted on a parapet of a rooftop inside the city of Mexico City and was pounding away with a little 6-pound brass cannon at some Mexican artillery. That was Ulysses Grant. They were both graduates of West Point. They both knew each other. When our forces landed at Veracruz and advanced through Puebla and into Mexico City, they were outnumbered by 3-1. And the general who was over them was Santa Anna. It was you think Santa Anna went away after San Jacinto? Oh, no. He was our prisoner, but he was paroled on the guarantee that he would never take up arms against the United States again, and promptly went down to Mexico City, became the dictator, rallied a huge army of about 20, 30,000 men, and tried to defeat the United States. It was so narrow. Our troops were exhausted, battle after battle, like at Puebla, where they would lose 1,000 men at a time with old-fashioned muskets and bayonets. It was so close. We could have lost the war against Mexico. The Civil War. You ought to read about it. You ought to read about the War of 1812. John Paul Jones, whose ship was shot to kindling nearly and on fire, and he said, I have not yet begun to fight. You ought to read about Moctezuma. You know where the Marine Corps hymn came from? From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli? Well, Montezuma is the Chapultepec castle down in Mexico City. That was called Moctezuma, who was one of the conquerors of Mexico. And the Marines were there, and they stormed that place. World War II, so narrow. If you read about the Battle of the Bulge, you have a gentleman in the front row here who was there, who was among those who actually relieved some of the captives at some of these torture camps like Dachau, Auschwitz, Buchenwald, whichever one. Mr. E.B. Vance was there in the army at that time. And it was so narrow in so many ways. In all theaters, it was such a near thing. I know that Almighty God intervened in dozens of ways throughout the wars that this nation has fought to give us our freedom and our liberty. And I give him the glory and the gratitude for it, because when you look at the decisions taken by generals and some of the fumbling, unbelievable, messed up foibles and mistakes that were made by the troops in the field. For example, let me just give you one. This is painful. The Army decided it would find a way to get tanks ashore at Normandy. And so somebody came up with a ridiculous notion that what they could do is to have like an inflatable rubber bathtub built around the sides of the tank. And they could simply waddle into the water and inflate this great big huge rubber bathtub, and it would displace enough water to more than compensate for the weight of the tank. So here's the most ungainly looking thing you ever saw, a Patton or a Sherman tank waddling around, and they tested them. They tested them in the lochs of Scotland. But on D-Day, there had been a huge storm, and it was still very stormy, and you've read all about it. On June 6, 1944, this huge armada was already at sea, thousands of ships, and about a half a million or more men that were going to pour ashore at Normandy, and the waves were just white-capping. So here come these great big LCTs and all these other ships, and they open up the front end, and the tanks waddle, and they inflate and go like a stone to the bottom, because they had been tested in calm lakes and they'd never been tested in high seas 6-7 feet tall. And the men drowned like rats. If you study the Battle of the Bulge, at what a near thing it was that we almost lost World War II. If you study the development of the Messerschmitt 262, the first operational jet fighter the United States came up against that Hitler had before we ever had a jet fighter, and the tremendous attrition they took against our bombers that went over Berlin and all of Germany and occupied Europe. If you study the tragedy of Schweinfurt, it means pig town, and Schweinfurt way down deep in southeastern Germany, was a very long flight. The Germans resorted to all kinds of things, like flying above the bombers and dumping out ball bearings to fall through them from the top. They put great big cannon in their fighters, up to 37 millimeter. One half, approximately, of all of those 1,000 aircraft didn't make it back. Every airplane had 10 men in it. When you look at some of the great battles of World War II, and this includes Midway, study the Battle of Midway, where we had two aircraft carriers against a vast armada of the four that had attacked Pearl Harbor, the Kaga, Akagi, Hiryu, Soryu, and way behind them were some of the others, and the Shoho, and there was a huge armada of the greatest battleships way behind that were going to occupy Midway. And here came Yamamoto and this huge fleet. And on an absolute fluke, Torpedo 8, and there was one survivor, and I will not make any kind of a reference to his name, because somebody would misunderstand. One survivor out of an entire squadron of TBMs attacked those ships from sea level. They were huge. They were called Grumman Avengers. They had about a 3,000 horsepower engine. They flew very low. They had a huge ship-sized torpedo, not a smaller one, in their bomb bay. They had two gunners and a pilot. Same kind of an airplane that George Bush's father flew and was shot down in near, I believe, Iwo Jima, near that, on another one called Ichishishijima, whatever, during World War II. Torpedo 8, it was called, from one of our aircraft carriers. And they flew low level. And the top cover of the Zeros came down and attacked them and shot down every single one of those bombers. The entire squadron was just slaughtered. A man named Wade McCluskey in dive bombers with a couple of squadrons of them was searching. They were about out of gas. They were about to turn back when somebody looked down and the clouds parted and they happened to see some little tiny wakes down there and some little dots that were Japanese ships. Or they would never have discovered them. And the dive bombers started down. But in the meantime, there had been all kinds of decisions and foul-up because they discovered that with the torpedo bombers, the Japanese obviously knew that there were American aircraft carriers out there somewhere. And they had been equipped with bombs to bomb Midway. So they had to come onto the decks and to fill up the decks of those four carriers and to completely rearm them and to rearm them with torpedoes to sink those ships. They were in the rearming process when Wade McCluskey and all of his people found those ships and started dive bombing them. Well, all the Zeros were down at low level. They didn't know that our dive bombers were even there till they saw them at about 2,000 or 3,000 feet above their heads. And we sank all four of those Japanese aircraft carriers, and it was an absolute turning point in the war in the Pacific. I don't look at any of those things as just happenstance. I look at them as a divine hand of God saying, I'm going to save these people. I'm going to rescue this nation. I'm going to make sure that this country survives. I'm not going to let them be occupied by the Germans and Italians or the Japanese. I'm not going to let them be occupied by the Mexicans or the Spanish. When I see what happened, I've told about it before at San Jacinto, when Sam Houston was accused of being a coward and a lot of people deserted, and a lot of his own men wanted to shoot him because he kept going and leading Santa Ana ever deeper up into Texas after what happened to the Alamo. And he was gathering like a local militia. You know that Davy Crockett died in the Alamo. And you know that Jim Bowie died in the Alamo. Well, here came a lot of other Tennesseans and people from way up in Virginia. And they joined Sam Houston's little ragtag army. The battle, when he finally got to San Jacinto and surprised Santa Ana, lasted for 8 minutes. And nearly 1,000 Mexicans bit the dust at a cost of something like 19 Texans. One of the most lopsided victories reminds you of what happened in Iraq. One of the most lopsided victories in the history of war. And that's why we live in Texas as free Texans and why we live in the southern part of the United States in a free country. If you don't look at history and study how God Almighty intervened, you don't really understand how to give God the glory for what you have. David knew that. David exulted in God. He exulted in his laws. He exulted in his statutes and judgments. Every word that came out of God's mouth to David was absolutely precious. I want you to turn to one of the most important Psalms, Psalm 104, verse 1. This follows Psalm 103, and it's good to read Psalm 103 because that's where he says that he forgiveth all thine iniquities and healeth all thy diseases. And following right on, he says, bless the eternal, O my soul. O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with honor and majesty, who cover yourself with light as with a garment, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain. When it's nighttime and you see cloud-to-cloud lightning and you hear the thunder rolling, or if you see some of the incredible power of the winds of a tornado or a hurricane, you know that the power of several atomic bombs are unleashed in one big thunderstorm, more than all of man's explosive forces. And he says, who layeth the beams of his chambers in the waters. This is metaphor. It's talking about beams, meaning something that would be used to support a building, but he's talking about the oceans now, and makes the clouds his chariot, who walks upon the wings of the wind. That's beautiful poetry, isn't it? But it conveys a message to you. When I was flying a jet aircraft and I would look down at the fjords of Iceland, or I'd look down at the eastern shore of Greenland and look at those huge icebergs there, what do you suppose the biggest iceberg that was ever found in history? Anybody want to make a guess? 2 miles wide? 5 miles? Could that be thought of? How about 10 or 12 miles? No, largest iceberg that ever broke off and floated in the North Atlantic was 120 miles long. And only a little part of it was above the surface. About 8/10 of it is below, which is what sunk the Titanic. The awesome power of the seasons and how God causes places like Iceland and Greenland to have such a huge snow cap and the polar ice caps, absolutely awesome to look at. And I've seen things flying in that Falcon and enjoyed things like you wouldn't believe. You'd fly through like corridors with castles and battlements. And many a time I would have people look out the window and it would be great big, like big mashed potatoes right out the window, clear up 40-some thousand feet. Many times I would go right next to one, not a powerful thunderstorm, but a little part of it, and just barely go through a part of it with one wing and say, get ready for a bump. And we would feel like that, and then we would be through it, and we're on the other side. And it's just so awesome to be able to be free of the earth and flying among the clouds like that and to enjoy it because it really does teach you something. Verse 4, who makes his angels spirits, his ministers, meaning the same thing as angels, another thing just repetitive, a flaming fire. That's not that his ministers are a flaming fire. And Mark and I were just telling Becky she hadn't heard about something that I saw in the news last couple of days. Some of you maybe saw. It was on the internet this morning. There was a preacher in Ohio that became sort of at a loss for words. And he was going on. And finally, he was just looking to God. And he was holding his hands up, I guess. He was saying, Lord, help me. Help me with what should I say? Show me what I should say. He wanted a sign. All of a sudden, boom. Lightning struck the steeple, came through the sound system, came out the microphone, bathed him in a blaze of fire. I don't know if it burned his hair and the eyelashes off or not, but I think it did him some damage. Didn't kill him. And I imagine the gentleman had a hard time explaining just what in the world had happened and what that was all about. I don't think since God says, Christ says, an adulterous generation seeks after a sign, but no sign shall be given it but the sign of Jonah the prophet, that a minister ought to be standing in a pulpit saying, show me a sign. I don't mean that. I'm just paraphrasing. That was in quotes. I don't think so. It says his minister is a flaming fire. And I've always told people the way you know that the wise men at the birth of Jesus were noonday volunteer firemen. The Bible says plainly they done come from afar. Anyway, I'm kidding. All right. Psalm 104:5. Who lays the foundations of the earth that it should not be removed forever. Where did basaltic and granitic rock come from? Where did it come from? You know what granite is made up of? Quartz, feldspar, plagioclase and orthoclase, and mica and hornblende. But how did it all get put together? There is such a thing as what they call bedrock. If you understand the rocks, I won't take much time, but you know that the pyroclastic rock called igneous are all coming from volcanoes, and they can actually form a basaltic column when they are revealed. All of the islands of Hawaii, for example, are volcanic. Tremendous amount of California and Oregon, volcanic. There's a huge spine of mountains called the Cascades, if you've ever been to Crater Lake, or if you've ever seen some of those wonderful cinder cones up there. You know where Mount St. Helens was, of course. You know where Rainier is, and it's semi-active. It isn't. It's quiet, but there's a potential for Rainier to act up. They're volcanic. Well, you can read a mountain if you see that a mountain is there and has huge granitic upthrust, like at Whitney and Whitney Portals, and on the side of it, there will be a beautiful black cinder cone with a lava flow down the side, which came first. Well, if you take your hands on your bed when you go home this evening, and you start on one side and you just push, what's going to happen in front of your hands? Folding like that, right? You ever study the Appalachians from the air? You ever look at the ring of fire, the way mountains are formed and all of the continents around the earth when God caused them to separate? Did you ever try to take South America and Africa, the bulge in Africa and the big indentation in South America and put them together? It works. Because at one time, anciently, there was one landmass, and God caused it all to grow. And that's another story, and a very lengthy one, but it's fascinating to read sedimentary rocks, which are waterborne and deposited, and, of course, then the rocks which are formed as a result of heat and pressure. which are metamorphosed or metamorphic rocks, where there are a lot of what are called slick insides. It's fantastic and it's wonderful. If you look at the foundations of the earth, David was a naturalist, as was his son. Where did Solomon get it from? Where did Solomon become such a lover of birds and fish and animals and insects and all the phenomena of weather, and to be such an observant person that he wrote a great deal about it? I think he got it from his father, and God gave it to him as well. Thou coverest it with the deep as with a garment. That's talking about all the oceans. 8/10 of the world is covered with water. The blue planet, the watery planet. The waters stood above the mountains. At thy rebuke they fled, as in a Red Sea, as at the Jordan River, as in other great phenomena that God has created. At the voice of thy thunder they hasted away. They go up by the mountains, they go down by the valleys into the place where you have founded for them. Talking about waters and talking about the rain that comes down and erodes. You have set a bound that they may not pass over, that they turn not again to cover the earth. So you can go to the ocean and you can see the waves crashing and booming and eroding away against some of the rock outcroppings or the beach. When we, I think it was in 1995, I forget, but we had the feast all scheduled at Panama City Beach. Remember that? I forget the year. And my sister Dottie and brother-in-law Vern Mattson were going to come over there and already had the tickets and were all ready. And we were packed and we were ready to go that early morning. We'd been watching the progress of this hurricane the night before. And until an hour or two before we're supposed to get in the car and drive to Dallas, we didn't know whether we're going or not. And some of our brethren had already gone down there and checked into their condos and hotels. And here came that hurricane. Well, it destroyed the beaches at Panama City Beach. It just washed them away. All of those tiki huts and things outside that resort where we stayed, blown away. The swimming pools completely full of sand. In the ensuing years, if you remember, some of you that went down there, they had these huge barges and these gigantic vacuum machines, and they were so huge, they're much bigger than I can reach around, and for years, spending millions and millions of dollars, and they had to do it because their entire tourist trade was gone. They exist on their tourist trade down there. They went out where that sand had been eroded and washed out to sea, and they just dredged it off the bottom and dumped it on the shore again and had to completely repair all those beaches. But you know, God has said that it can only come so far and no further. It's interesting when you look at where you live. Most people don't pay much attention to that. Why is Big Sandy called Big Sandy? A lot of sand. Where does sand come from? What is sand? Sand is the result of water and wind. Luss, L-O-E-S-S, is wind-blown or born sand, as the Great Sand Dune National Monument is, up in the San Luis Valley of Colorado, that came through a gap in the mountains as a result of the drying wind following the flood of Noah. But most sand along the seashore is, if you pick it up, a lot of it's white, and that's what? Tiny little granules like sugar of quartz. Now, you go how far inland? Well, from Panama City Beach, you can go miles inland and dig down, and what do you come upon? Shells. The driveways in home made of shells. What kind of storms do you suppose deposited sea bottom life that far inland? People had to learn a lesson. They still haven't, but they should have, about the flow of the Mississippi River. Mississippi River had a bed that was once about 120 miles wide. What you've got now is a little tiny river in what was once a vast flow of water off of this continent when the continent was lifted after the flood of Noah and the land was beginning to be dried. And they have what are called oxbow lakes. That's because they're shaped like an oxbow. And there are beautiful lakes by the hundreds all along both sides of the Mississippi River that are just lakes upon which, if you fly over them, you will see homes and docks and boats and people are fishing and recreation along those lakes. I think the phenomena of creation, of our earth, of our skies, of all the animals, the birds and the insects with which we share this ecosphere should be studied. If I study a painting and look in awe at the dexterity and the incredible artistry of someone that is able to make a scene look like a photograph, then if I look at nature as I'm speaking about, I also am learning a great deal about the kind of a mind that produced all of that, that made all of that. So those beaches are the result of erosion of gigantic storms beyond your or my ability to imagine that reduced hard rock, original rock, into sand. Someone sent, you know, South Padre Island, gray sand. Nowhere near as much quartz. Panama City Beach, white sand, beautiful. Sun sand, where can you go to find black sand? Anybody know? Big Island of Hawaii and Iwo Jima. Volcanic rock that was eroded and caused to become black sand. So like little tiny grains of sugar, but black sand. Not very pretty to track in onto the rug. I look at all of these things and it just amazes me. If I am amazed at, well, for example, have you ever been to the assembly line of an automobile manufacturing factory? Have you ever been to a glass blowing factory to see how they make fine crystal? You seen the machines that take that molten, red, glowing, waxen-looking substance that is nothing more than quartz that has been melted to the melting point, put it in, and make those delicate little goblets and glasses that housewives prize so much. So thin, some of them, almost paper-thin, little vials and things that are used in laboratory experiments, for example, all in a glass-making factory. Most people go through their lives, and they do not go out of their way as they're traveling to go see how things are made, how things are formed, and let their kids get that kind of an education. I was very blessed when my dad and mom took a baptizing tour in 1946 in our old 1941 DeSoto. My brother Dick and I was just learning to drive. I was 16. We drove through, in 3 months, 40 states. We drove all the way from Miami, Florida, to Portland, Maine on U.S. Highway 1 with frequent detours here and there. We only missed some of the states, like I think we missed Kentucky and maybe West Virginia, and I think we missed North Dakota. But we made so many states, transversing all up and down the United States. My father baptized people in Cotulla, Texas, and in Gladewater, Texas, and all over the place. I was 16, and I got to see Monticello. And I got to see Mount Vernon. And I got to climb to the top of the Statue of Liberty. And I got to go to the top of the Empire State Building. And I got to see the great monuments of the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. I saw the Southern White House and where Robert E. Lee worked. I saw all these wonderful things. Saw the great ships in Boston Harbor. Saw Norfolk, Virginia, the Naval Base. Saw all these wonderful things. 16. Made such a tremendous impression on me that I was insatiable learning about American history and about geography from that time on and even before. But certainly that made a great impression because travel like that is extremely educational and very broadening. And most people are non-observant. I will talk to people that I golf with and say, you know what kind of a tree that is? No, I never noticed that tree before. Well, it's a beautiful tulip poplar. Most beautiful shape you ever saw. I want to know what those trees are. What they're like. And how they are either deciduous or, as you know, which trees do you know that look like they're evergreen but are not? You ever hear of a tamarack? Over in Europe, they turn a golden orange or a yellow. But they look like a fir tree, but they got needles, and they shed the needles. I'll go on and on with this 4 hours later. So it says here, it's talking about me, I think, Psalm 104:16, the trees of the eternal are full of sap. And sometimes I think maybe I am too. The cedars of Lebanon, which he has planted. Yeah, he planted. Who made the first cedar of Lebanon? We had big flanking rows of cedars of Lebanon at the college in Brickett Wood. And we had what is called a deodar, which is a cousin to it, in our backyard in Pasadena. Just gorgeous. Cedars of Lebanon are mentioned many times in the Old Testament. And the wood was brought from Hiram to Solomon for the building of the temple. I don't know of a more beautiful tree. Well, all trees are beautiful to me, but some are more beautiful than others. Where the birds make their nest, verse 17, is for the stork, the fir tree is her house. We came across in my deodar in the backyard one time a hummingbird nest. It was as big as a silver dollar. It was as deep as a teaspoon, perfectly round. I touched it. It was made of spider webs and little tiny bits and pieces of leaves that had been woven together. It was pliable, very lightweight, so tiny I couldn't believe it. And we have right now a feeder in the backyard and little female ruby throats are feeding at it, and she is so tiny, she is probably, not quite 2 inches high, and her beak is about a third of her body size. Cutest little thing you ever saw. Well, I've studied evolution, and I've also studied creation, and I know that evolution doesn't have a fin, a feather, or a leg to stand on. The high hills are a refuge for the wild goats, the chamois, or the ibex, and the rocks for the cronies. He has appointed the moon for seasons. The sun knows his going down. What is David talking about? He says, bless the eternal, O my soul. Love God. Worship God. Appreciate God. And how does he do it? He talks about nature. Talks about the wonderful animals, birds, fish, insects, and even the seasons and the universe and the solar system and the earth. The sun knoweth his going down. You make darkness, and it's night, wherein all the beasts of the forest do creep forth. The young lions roar after their prey and seek their meat from God. The sun arises, they gather themselves together and lay them down in their dens. Man goes forth unto his work and to his labor until the evening. Does that sound like something Solomon might have heard as a boy? Because it's reminiscent of what Solomon wrote about, isn't it? O eternal, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom have you made them all. The earth is full of your riches. In some ways, I'd rather go to Colorado at snowline and maybe a tree line and look at what I can see there than I would to go to a great museum. But either one is something that I really enjoy. If you've ever been to the Museum of Natural History in Chicago, Illinois, or the one down at USC campus in Southern California. I've been to the one in Chicago, and I've walked where you used to be able to do this, you can't anymore, inside the rib cage of gigantic dinosaurs, and seen Tyrannosaurus rex, and Brontosaurus, and Stegosaurus, and some of these huge creatures that could barely get inside this auditorium. And it is awesome because I think some of them are mentioned in the book of Job when God brought out his handiwork to break down Job's self-righteousness and convict him of the power of God and make Job see just how great God really is from Job's 40th chapter onward. So is this great and wide sea wherein are things creeping innumerable, both small and great beasts. Many years ago off the coast of South Africa in one of the deep trenches where the Humboldt Current is active, a fisherman came in with an eel which was something like, 8 or 10 or 12 feet long. And they determined it was a baby eel of a species of giant eel. So they went fishing for this giant eel. And they had like a 3/16 inch cable, a very powerful cable on a gigantic winch or a drum. And they used a hook about as big as your arm. And they put half of a pig on the hook. And they let it down several thousand feet, and they trolled slowly along. And they had a strike, and the strike broke the cable. They never did find out what it was. Which reminds me of another story. Now this is tongue-in-cheek, placed firmly in cheek. There's a picture of the sports fishing boat. There are three fighting chairs. You know the way they are, they're anchored to the deck, and they have the thing there, you put the butt of the big deep sea rod in, and you're fighting the sailfish or the marlin. And the man on one side and the other are looking at this chair in the middle, which has now disappeared. And there are four great big bolts that are turned like that, and they are smoking, just absolutely hot. And one fellow turns to the other one and says, I wonder what he had. Only fishermen will get that. I see some of you women are having trouble with that. But it meant that he was, never mind. Strapped into his chair. All right. All these wait upon thee. Oh, there in verse 26, there go the ships. There is that Leviathan whom thou hast made to play therein. And when you look at some of these great sea creatures, they are awesome. These wait all upon thee that you may give them their meat in due season. You give them, they gather. You open your hand, they are filled with good. I once mentioned to you that when you are scuba diving or you're snorkeling and you see a fish come up and doing like that, he is asking a question. Every time a fish moves his mouth and looks at you, he's asking food, food, food. That's what they're looking for continually. Just like birds hopping around. Food, food, where's food? That's what all animals, all creatures, even insects, and especially mosquitoes, when they see me walk by, they know that is food. And so anyway, I am especially susceptible. That thou givest them, they gather. You open your hand, verse 28, they are filled with good. You hide your face, they are troubled. You take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. You send forth your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the earth. The glory of the Eternal shall endure forever. The Eternal shall rejoice in his works. What joy must it have been to the one who became Jesus Christ and God the Father, who may have talked and planned and thought and created in their minds for a billion years. You think they did it in 10 minutes? Study the digestive tract of a stork. Study the nesting habits of a goose, a migratory waterfowl. Look at the tern as I ask, how far does it take for a tern to turn? 6,000 miles. They leave from way up above the Arctic Circle at the very height of their food availability and start way out to sea and even fly at night and go all the way to the South Pole. Then they turn around, they're out of sight of land, and the only way they can migrate is by the stars or by magnetic pulses, who knows. And the Arctic tern is the longest flighted bird. It makes the longest migratory pattern of any creature known to man. Some creatures migrate up and down, like krill or plankton, depending upon pressure and temperature. Others migrate, like the monarch butterfly, from central California to Sonora, Mexico. Fascinating study. The glory of the Eternal shall endure forever. The Eternal shall rejoice in his works. Do you ever get great satisfaction out of something you did? I used to carve. I used to build little model airplanes. And when I painted, I get a certain amount of satisfaction. I get a certain amount of satisfaction out of preaching a good sermon for a change instead of some that I wish I had never preached. I get satisfaction, as both my wife and I do, when something has been done around the house, and she does most of it. But when we are completely through with like a spring cleaning project and the yard is mowed and the house is in great order, there's a great deal of satisfaction that you receive. So when you do something and you're happy with it, you produce something, you've invented, designed something, you rejoice in that. How much joy does God get out of his works? Well, back to my analogy of a child, how much joy did we receive when we saw our first child born? What kind of an accomplishment was that? He looks on the earth and it trembles. He touches the hills and they smoke. I will sing unto the Eternal as long as I live. So will I, and I hope so will you. I will sing praise to my God while I have my being. If I'm stove up someday in a wheelchair and can hardly move, I'll still be able to sing to God. Still be able to look out the window and see a sunset. Still be able to realize by looking at the things that God has created how great he is. My meditation of him shall be sweet. I will be glad in the Eternal. Let the sinners be consumed out of the earth, and let the wicked be no more. Bless thou the Eternal, O my soul. Praise ye the Lord. What a beautiful psalm, and rich with meaning, every single verse of it. You know, over in Matthew 5, 43 to 48, God says, in essence, it is impossible for two people to love God and to hate each other. It's impossible. It cannot be. It's utterly impossible. I've oftentimes wondered about some of those who feel that they are my enemies. And they're not from my point of view, but I may be their enemy from their point of view. But I'm not. It's a one-sided deal. And we're all sitting there together, a few miles apart. A city or a county apart. Or a nation apart. 1,000 miles apart. But we're all sitting there together, watching the Super Bowl. And sometimes rooting for the same team. Watching a tennis match. Watching a basketball game. Watching a football game. And then, oh yeah, I confess. I watch sports on television when I'm able to, when it's not interfering with something else. And usually, from 7 to 9 or so at night, it doesn't interfere with something else. I do most of my work from way early in the morning until mid-morning or later. But it's interesting to me when I think about that. Because sometimes we frequent the same restaurants. We order the same kind of food.
We buy our clothing in the same stores. We travel the same streets, the same roads. But we never see one another. Fascinating when I just think about it. I just meditate on that. That's strange, isn't it? We're sharing without sharing. We're together without being together. It doesn't make sense. Well, there you are. Jesus said, you have heard it said, this is chapter 5, verse 43 of Matthew, you've heard it has been said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven, for he makes his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. There we are, all enjoying the same sunlight, all enjoying the same shower. Whether good, whether evil, whether alienated, or whether together. There we are. For if you love them which love you, what good is it? What reward do you have? Don't even the publicans the same? Oh yeah, Satanists love Satanists, and gays love gays, and people that hate the United States that are rag-headed, weird, hateful Shias or Sunni Muslims who maybe are the Wahhabi sect of Saudi Arabia that want to kill every one of us, love each other. They're brothers. They kiss each other on the cheek about three times, men with beards when they meet. Disgusts me to death. See somebody come up to Yasser Arafat with those big old liver lips sitting out there between all that wispy beard and mustache, kissing him on, you may as well just go kiss a garbage can as far as I'm concerned. It just makes me sick to look at that. But they do. They love each other. They love one another. No matter what evil is going on in their mind, no matter how many Jews and Christians they want to kill, brother, how are you? How's my happy Fedayeen out there? They love one another. Doesn't make sense, but they do. For if you love them which love you, what reward have you? Do not even the publicans the same? And if you salute your brethren only, what do you more than others? Do not even the publicans so? If you run across someone that you feel is alienated from you, greet them warmly. Don't play the I'm going to out-Christian you game. Just greet them warmly and go on about your business. You've opened the door. Be the first to greet them. That's what Jesus Christ wants us to do. Do not even the publicans so. Be you, and the Greek word is in the aorist or the progressive, become ye therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. Now, how can you obey that command that is given to us? You shall love the Eternal your God with all your heart and with all your soul, meaning with all your being, and with all your might, with all of your strength. He went on to say in Deuteronomy 6:6, and these words which I command thee this day shall be in your heart, and you shall teach them diligently unto your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house. How many parents talk, sitting in their house, of many of the things I've mentioned in this sermon? How many parents tell children about the refraction and reflection of light? How many parents simply look up a high school level encyclopedia like World Book and look up air and talk to their children about it? Or water? Or light? I dare say one out of several million, if that many. They just don't do it. You teach laws. What is law? Beside ontological law, beside man-made law, there is basic law, and it requires a lawgiver. You are pinioned right now to your seat by law, and you can't break it except for the strength of your legs. But you can't fly, no matter how many times you dream that you could. You don't go hurling off into space, and 8,000 miles straight down there are other people sitting in exactly the opposite direction, and they're pinioned to this earth by gravity, and that is a law. And the one who made and ordained that, man can try to define it, but he didn't invent it. Man didn't create it, and man doesn't sustain it. The one who invented that and designed that, the gravitational field of all the planets that holds in its velvet grasp our Earth, with our moon going around our Earth and the two of them going around the sun once a year, is the God that we worship and the one we know of as Jesus Christ of Nazareth, who designed it, thought it out, and brought it into being and said, "Let there be light." And let the dry land appear.
and let the oceans bring forth the great creatures. You shall teach them diligently unto your children, shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way. Comment on what you see walking by. The trees, the grass, the flowers, the bees, the insects, the animals. And when you lie down and when you rise up. And he said, they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You know, I can forget my ring. I forget that I wear it. Keep it on all the time. Sleep with it on. I can forget my watch. But if I had a frontlet, if I had something over my head and dangling between my eyes, some kind of a little medallion that was right here, every time I bend over, it goes out and I set up, come back and whacks me between the eyes, I would know it is there. I could never forget it. If it's a frontlet, and that's a kind of a piece of jewelry that I'm talking about, like frontlets between your eyes, if God's law is like a frontlet, you can never forget it. Well, I hope that I have helped all of us today to know a little bit more how we can love the eternal our God with all of our hearts.